All right. Good morning. Our first case, I hope I pronounced this correctly, is In Re the Estate of John Kenneth, I hope I pronounced it, is it Rutt? As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone. The platform goes up and down, adjust it to your level, and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning. My name is Roxanne Carl, and I'm the attorney for appellate David Rutt. My client appeals from the district court order granting a partial distribution of $91,000 in this estate. The district court, in granting the motion of respondents, denied my client's motion in its entirety. My client sought the district court should review the inactions and actions of the respondents before granting that partial distribution. So today we have seven issues before the court. The first issue is with respect to taxes. In this particular case, fiduciaries are obligated to file tax returns. And the test that triggers that is if there's $600 of gross income in a calendar year.
So that argument turns on the question of whether interest accrued on the judgments is income, correct?
That is part of it, correct.
And what's the legal authority for that proposition?
Well, the legal authority partly is interest income under the Internal Revenue Code is income, and what categorizes it as income in this case is if you look at the reconciliation document filed by the respondents. That document shows an accounting of all the monies that were received, and then it also shows by looking at the amount of the judgments, as they were satisfied, you can see the amount they paid, so you can tell the amount that was interest and the amount that was principal.
But my question is, what legal authority says that interest on a judgment is the same as earned interest for purposes of being counted as income?
Because interest on a judgment, like under the judgment interest statute, which says interest that you earn is money that you pay as a result of having a contract out there or some other type of judgment order. Like in how it determines how you would apply that is if you look at that document that I attached on the judicial reform, how to the judicial form that sets forth how you compute the principal and the interest, and then it tells you when you collect this, you must first apply it to interest and then to principal. So when you set this up, this wasn't just the court saying, hey, you owe X dollars. It was a court saying, you owe X dollars. But you know what? In this state, we have prejudgment interest. And under that new statute, 549, as it was amended, it's going to be 10% on a couple of these. And that 10% generated $8,000 of income per year.
And well, at the end of the day, Ms. Carl, I mean, if, let's say for the sake of argument, we agree with you and they should have reported interest. Then, you know, the IRS will go after respondents, and that's their problem. How does that get you?
It gets us in a couple ways. First of all, the IRS is looking and says, you owe X dollars, and you have an estate account. They're going to look to the estate account. Because they
and then
don't
I
know
assume
anything.
At some point, if they're looking at the estate account, the estate in turn will go after respondents.
Correct.
And, you know, no harm, no foul. If indeed the IRS ever does this,
right.
Which of course is speculative.
Well, the harm and foul could be is that if there isn't enough, if they don't have the ability to pay it, they go looking to what had been paid out in the estate. Therefore, they go after all the heirs.
And presumably you could sue for a cross claim saying they should indemnify your client because he wasn't in charge of it at this point. It's their fault.
Correct.
So once again,
but the indemnification,
I fail to see how this prevents a distribution.
If they can't pay the taxes.
Again, this does assume the IRS is going to do this.
Okay.
And you know, I'll simply take judicial notice that the IRS doesn't seem to be much of doing anything these days, and I don't know if they're going to be target number one when it comes to getting their funding back. So, I mean, this could happen, but the question is, should this as a matter of law prevent a distribution? And I guess that's my question, Ms. Carl.
Well, part of it is because that there may not be enough funds by doing this distribution. So in order to protect that so it doesn't happen, I mean, you're not looking at a long period of time. If they filed the tax returns and can show us that and nothing's owed, Bingo. But we don't have the tax returns. We don't know. And when we look at it, it looks like there's significant income that was earned, not just accrued, but it was earned because it was paid. And to show that it was paid, you look at their accounting because they're showing, oh, yeah, we satisfied this judgment. We paid all the principal and all the interest. And on the large judgment that's still out there, the only judgment that's unsatisfied, they're mainly paying interest, a small
amount. So that means the estate will continue to get, according to your argument, income from these interest payments into the future. So wouldn't that be enough to satisfy any potential IRS claim down the road?
Well, in 2013, there was $130-some thousand of payments to the estate. And in one of the payoff part of one of them, there was over $40,000 of interest. So with all of that coming in, with that one, certainly it wasn't accrued because it paid it off, and then they got the interest in the payment. Clearly that amount had it. And if it was $40,000, it could be that they could have a 35% interest rate on that. It could be significant. Plus you have to have late filing fee, and then you have to have the late penalty, and then you have to have the interest. And you add all them up, and it could be quite significant. And we have $12,000 in the account.
In the, I guess it's, I'm not good at math. In the 13 years since the decedent passed away, has the IRS ever sent, does the record indicate that the IRS has ever sent a notice to the trustees indicating problems here, we're going to send an audit?
We have no idea because we can't get even a copy of the tax returns from them for the 3 years that they now claim they filed. When we requested them and there was a stipulation, we never received anything. All we have is a reply affidavit by Ms. Bregeman saying that they filed them in 10, 11, and 12, which would be the three likely years that you would not file them because they weren't generating income at that time.
Okay, but we're not here on an order denying your client's access to tax records, right? I mean, that's not a direct appeal issue.
No, it isn't.
Okay. And I'm still getting back to the question of whether this interest you pay on a judgment is the same as interest you earn on an account in a bank. I mean, isn't the interest that's owed on a judgment, the pre-judgment, post-judgment interest, a reflection of the time value of money and the fact that the debtor was, at the time the action was commenced or sometime before that, entitled to this money in total?
They weren't entitled to this money until there was a judgment entered by the court. And the only reason they got it is because our state happens to have a pre-judgment and post-judgment interest statute. It's not a sure thing. But under this statute, it allowed them to have that. And that's why we're saying it's different because that part is not part of the actual recovery. That part is as a like a penalty. We're going to give you this also.
One point the respondent makes, Ms. Carl, in their brief, is that, and what triggered this was the mention of the affidavits. You know, were these arguments properly raised below? I mean, if all an affidavit was filed, was there case law presented to the district court or arguments? Because perhaps if that happened, you know, the district court would have been able to address these issues more fully. So why aren't most of these issues waived?
Well, because they were presented to the court below. They were presented in the form of affidavits.
Right, but an affidavit saying, you know, I should win is not the same as presenting case law to the district court, arguments to the district court, you know, detailed information so that the court could make its decision. And so my question is, was that done, you know, along the lines that I'm asking?
No, these are basically factual situations which required affidavits with the facts and then attaching the documents that were necessary to assist the court as far as, you know, when such a tax return is required.
So was there argument presented?
Yes, there's a transcript of the argument. Okay.
And did you cite case law to the district court indicating?
Not during the argument, no.
Okay. You know, I'd like to jump quickly to one separate issue, and that's on the boats.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had a couple of questions there. So did your client pay for the boat?
Yes, he did.
Okay. Was title delivered?
No, it wasn't.
Okay. All right. Do you believe then your client should get a credit then for the boat against whatever it is he owes?
That was the remedy we asked for.
And what is the amount of the, or does the record indicate what the fair market value is of the boat?
The record indicates what he paid for it.
And what was that?
$4,555, right around there. $4,600.
What evidence is that I know that was the bid amount, but mm-hmm. what evidence is there in the record that your client actually paid that amount to the estate?
Well, you can look to the reconciliation document, and that reconciliation document talks about the personal property that my client was awarded, and my client was awarded about $10,000 of personal property, and it shows that judgment has fully been paid. In fact, it was paid in 2015, so even though he paid it in 15, no title.
Does he have the boat right now?
He has a boat, but you need a title to operate it in Minnesota. And they're obligated
to
transfer.
Operated in Minnesota?
Yes, you need a title for a boat.
Well, I know you need a title for a boat. I have a title for a boat, but I don't ever have it. I don't need it to operate my boat. I don't understand your argument there.
Well, the statute, under my understanding, is that you need a certificate of title for a boat, which he does not have. And the PRs are obligated to transfer when someone has purchased something from the estate. It's their obligation. And if they don't do it, you're entitled to damages for them not doing it.
Does he have a receipt of actually paying money for this boat?
Pardon me?
Does he have a receipt that he got? Here, you know, you pay money, you buy a boat, you get a receipt for what you bought. Is there anything in the record to that effect?
There's record evidence showing that it had been paid for.
The reconciliation you're referring to.
The reconciliation, and also if you look in the, it's tied together on that accounting form, which they attached the bids to, and it showed who got each bid,
right.
What they got, and then they added up those totals to say this is what he owes. And then they named it as a judgment, and it's been fully paid.
Okay, I guess one of your arguments that you should get the boat and the credit? I don't see how you get both.
No.
Okay. So he's got the boat. The only thing you want is the title.
Yep. They can have the boat and the motor.
Well, I thought you have the boat.
We have the boat, but he wants the credit. We have the boat, but we don't have any ability to utilize it. We don't have the title.
Meaning right. He can't get the license because he doesn't have the title.
Yes. So what we're saying is, fine, he just wants the credit. That's the remedy he wants now. He's been damaged by not having it. He paid this amount of money. He'd like it. Paid it 3 years ago.
And what is... Then he'd have to give the boat back.
Pardon me?
Then he would obviously have to get the boat back.
Obviously, yes.
And so you're saying you believe he's entitled to a credit of $4,455 based on what he bid?
What he bid and what he paid.
Okay, fair enough.
And by payment, as I understand it, it's the satisfaction
of
that amount,
of the
judgments to the extent of that bid.
Yes, okay. And that judgment for personal property contained various items of personal property. The boat being one, as was the wedding ring and flatware.
You're up.
I'm up, okay. Right. So with respect to attorney's fees in this case, we are contending that there were some unnecessary fees that... with respect to the Cass County property, a simple look at the owner's encumbrances should have told the parties that there's no equity in the property. Yet, they went through an entire year with this file open. They commenced an action in Cass County, and then it was 5 months later before they ever even looked at the owner's and encumbrances report. And then even though then they saw that they had no equity, they continued the file for a year. We consider that to be unnecessary funds, and those funds should be refunded to the estate by the personal representative or however they want to do that, because that is funds that the other heirs were deprived of, not just my client, but the other heirs also.
Well, to be fair, it looks like, I mean, this is the third appeal arising out of this
that
estate.
Is correct.
I mean, it looks like there was information that should have been shared by all parties way early on in this proceeding. So, had your client been more forthcoming about his decisions and the crowing property, you know, early on, it seems to me there is some accountability on all sides in terms of how long it took to resolve some of those issues. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Well, yes, it took some time, but I think the reason all this happened was because of how the initial judge fashioned the remedy in this case. Because instead of just rescinding the purchase of the home by one child to the dad, they decided to come up with a different type of remedy, and that remedy was setting these accounts receivable.
But those were subjects of the earlier appeals.
That's correct.
So, I mean, we can't go back and change that now.
We can't change it, but this has been carried on because of that. Because he has this, you know, his interest rate on it is 10%. He can't pay it. And they say, well, why doesn't he just take care of it like his brother did? Well, his brother went out and sold the house his wife owned. We don't have that situation here. He can't pay it. So he's doing the best he can with it. He offered to settle, and that's why one of those mortgages went on that property up in Cass County. It went up there to get the funds to settle. But no, they wouldn't settle because they wanted the full amount, all the interest. And see, when it was set up, the value of the house was $40,000, and because of the 5 years at the interest rate, now it's $80,000. And it continues at 10%. So it's kind of like a loan shark, you know, because how are you going to pay this down? He's only now, in this year, started to do a small amount of decrease on the principal on the last judgment after all these years.
Quite frankly, I don't have any understanding right now what any of this has to do with the issue that's before us. We're here on whether the distribution should have been approved or not, not about how or what he's paying on these judgments right now. So what does that argument even have to do with the issues that are before us?
Well, there's some animosity regarding, you know, that he's not taking care of this, and we wouldn't be here if he hadn't done this and that. We're just saying that, you know, he's doing the best he can to do this, to make sure it's taken care of.
Thank you, Ms. Carl. You will have rebuttal.
Pardon me?
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondents, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Rod Crass, representing the respondents in this matter. And the first thing I'd like to say to you is we have to be very careful in this appeal as to the facts that have been argued, because almost none of what you have heard from counsel was before the trial court. There was simply the affidavit from Mr. Rutt, and with a lot of self-serving conclusions about what should have been done or what was owed. There was no legal memorandum. There was no legal citations, as Judge Conley was asking about, either in the submittals or in the arguments before the trial court. So when counsel keeps referring to documents or accounts that she's relying upon, none of that is in this file. It's in previous files, now referenced by counsel, but never referenced as part of her motion. We went in there perfectly blind, not really knowing what the legal arguments were or how to respond to them. As you can see in the transcript, at one point, counsel suggested to the court that the court undertake a separate investigation of some of these issues or have a CPA look at the tax issues, asking the court to do this. If there were tax issues, there should have been a CPA or some expert testimony in the form of an affidavit which indicated what those issues were and what the opinion of that provider was, so we could have responded to it. We owe no taxes. We know we owe no taxes. And the argument about possibility of owing taxes in the future is spurious. They don't exist. We don't have any tax obligations and never have had any tax obligations.
Counsel, if I could just interrupt on the question of the boat. Appellant's counsel stated that a reconciliation document, I believe from 2015, I might have that year wrong, indicates that in fact the appellant did pay for, or his payments in satisfaction of a judgment took care of the bid price of $4,550 or so for that boat. Is that true? Is that, does that what the record tell us?
Not this record. That information is in the court files because the court files include all of those filings for subsequent years. But that issue and those numbers and that citation were never provided or hinted at by the appellant before the trial court. It just wasn't in evidence.
But but it is of record, right?
It's of record. It happened.
And what is the number? What is the number? Is it 4,400 and?
I didn't go back and look. I'll accept counsel's representation.
Well, would you agree that, if that's true, it seems to me, he should get title to the boat. I mean, whether he gets to give it back and get a credit is a separate issue, but at the very least, wouldn't it be fair to say that your clients are responsible for giving him title to the boat? Would that be a fair statement, Mr. Kress?
If we had the title, it would be our responsibility. There is nothing in this record indicating that has ever been requested until we got to these proceedings.
Sure. Well, let's say, for the sake of argument, what they did below is enough to request it. And whether it is or not, I'm saying it's an argument. Would it be fair to say that, it is the estate trustee's responsibility to kind of, get Ms. Carl's client the title if he, normally in most transactions, the seller's responsible for giving good title, to the bona fide purchaser.
I agree.
Okay, fair enough.
And I
would assume your clients would rather give title than get the boat back and get a credit.
Yes, after all these years of use, because it has been used.
I got it.
Okay.
And this was father's boat. This was the father's boat.
It was.
Okay.
It was. The argument that somehow the IRS, if we owed taxes, which we don't, but if we did, the IRS could go after after her client is, again, totally unsupported by the record. There's no indication of the law that applies here. All that was included that referenced taxes outside of Mr. Rutt's self-serving opinions about taxes, and he's in no position to give opinions about taxes, was a partial set, an incomplete set of instructions for an IRS form, which tells us how to fill out the form. Doesn't tell us anything about whether or not this estate owes taxes, which, as I've said, it does not. And so the concern that the IRS could somehow attack her client or attempt to collect taxes from her client is totally unsupported.
In a challenge to a final or a supplemental final accounting, which is the procedural posture of this case, who has the burden of proving that the estate handled things such as tax filings properly or accounted for its tax responsibilities appropriately?
I would say the estate does, Your Honor. And when we get to that point, we will, because we've got the documentation indicating that we have no tax obligation. We've gone through that process. But when we finally close this estate, which has only been kept open because of the debt and the judgments, we'll do that. And Mr. Rutt will have his opportunity at that final hearing to come to court and make whatever argument he can that we're wrong and our CPA is wrong and we owe taxes. And we'll deal with it at that point. Attorney's fees, the argument is that we proceeded with a collection effort on the Crow Wing County file, and we shouldn't have done that. You have to understand that at the time, they say they took out one of the loans to pay off this debt, and therefore, although it was a line of credit, it wasn't exercised at that point. We had no idea whether it was or not. And and the proper question, it seems to me, is where did the money go? If Mr. Rutt took this mortgage out to pay us and didn't pay us, why was the mortgage necessary? The other mortgage was by, as the court, trial court indicated, a very close personal friend of his. We were skeptical about both of these mortgages, and that's why it took 7 months after we filed it and obtained the information on the mortgages to determine whether or not there was validity to the mortgages. You have to keep in mind, Your Honor, counsel doesn't like to hear this, but the basis of our claims in the first place was fraud. And
that was the subject of prior appeals, correct?
Yes. My point being, we were skeptical of what David Rutt claimed was occurring with respect to the Crow Wing County file. And we don't know today whether or not there are, those mortgages are still valid and whether we should be taking another look at that property. And we may well do that in an effort to try and resolve this case. There's a considerable argument in the appellant's brief with respect to our application of payments received as a result of garnishment, because we have never voluntarily received a dime from this appellant with respect to the amounts that he owes, and no indication of where all the money that he received from his father went or the money he received as part of the mortgages on the property up north went. The application of those payments, counsel argues, should have been done in a manner that benefited her client and therefore was to the detriment of all the rest of the heirs, that the that we did something wrong by applying those garnished payments in a manner that best maintained the recovery that we had obtained in these judgments. And she cites no evidence to that. She cites no legal authority for that position. And the trial court rejected it. And the trial court rejected it properly, we believe, having, of course, in all of these issues, very broad discretion in probate issues, and not having been given by counsel any law to support this position that she takes, and has not presented any to you either. Counsel argues in her brief to you that it is clear error for the trial court to have authorized the distribution. Clear error. Again, I'd point out the broad discretion the trial court had and the lack of information in the trial court record that would help support this position, but it's based on an assumption, and counsel writes it in her brief. It is highly likely that the estate owes substantial taxes and penalties. It is highly likely. I don't know where that standard came from. It certainly doesn't exist in the law, but there is nothing supporting it in the trial record. To make this allegation that we have been delinquent in taking care of our tax obligations, and we clearly have not, and we know we have not, to make it just as a statement without any support from anyone, as would be required in a court of law to prove this allegation, it does not carry the day and certainly does not indicate that the trial court committed clear error. Where's the expert affidavit? What's substantial? How much are we talking about? Are we talking about more than Mr. Rutt owes and the amount he's obligated to pay to the estate at this point? And in fact, none of that is in the trial record, and none of it's supported. And I go back to my point that so much of what counsel has written in her appellate brief and reply brief indicates and refers to documents and factual matters that don't exist in the record before you. And the fact that she pulled them out of prior filings or determinations doesn't help the trial court in making its judgment, and certainly puts us at a disadvantage in not being able to respond to the trial court because those issues weren't brought up at the time that they should have, and not have those issues be tried in this court. At one point, counsel argued that the court, at a minimum, should have undertaken further investigation. And if the court had carefully and fully reviewed the concerns and correctly applied the law, it wouldn't have authorized the distribution. I've made the point, what law? She has given us no law. In talking about the taxes in the transcript at page 8, she said to the trial judge, I don't know if that is something the court can do, and she's talking about reviewing the tax returns that we had already filed, or is that something you need a CPA to look at? Good question. A question more appropriately from the trial court to counsel. Don't expect me, counsel, to do legal research and provide you with information you need to make your case. I've got broad discretion here. I've done what I'm supposed to do based on the information and the law you gave me. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Crass. Ms. Carl, you'll have the last word.
Just a few remarks in response to Mr. Crass's comments. You know, the court does have broad discretion in probate matters, but the court also cannot make mistakes of fact, and the court can't err in applying the law.
All right, I want to talk about the law, because there is something in my mind to this suggestion that you didn't give the district court any legal authority for what you were asking it to do. You presented affidavits and fact-based arguments, but didn't provide legal authority. So I'm asking you to do that for this court. What is your strongest legal authority that would lead us to conclude that the district court abused its discretion by authorizing this partial distribution?
Well, a lot of it goes to in the mistake of facts that
But I'm asking, what's the legal authority? Is there a case that says
on the legal authority,
when there are fact errors, that it's abuse of discretion? Any kind of legal authority that suggests...
I suppose the Bliss case.
Bliss?
Bliss.
Okay.
B-L-I-S-S.
And what does that case instruct?
That says basically if the judge were to pretty much verbatim take the proposed documents by the one party, that it probably wasn't impartial. So there were just all
Which is
these
not
things.
An argument you've advanced on appeal. You haven't said the district court was not impartial.
No, we said the facts are just, numerous facts are wrong. I mean, it's not just one or two. It's numerous facts are wrong. And that's why this is so much, it's a factual situation. It's not the law, it's the facts that are involved. We just ask that they investigate us. I don't know why we couldn't have just had a hearing to determine, okay,
let's see. You said the Bliss case? I don't see that cited in your brief. Maybe
it's not cited in the brief. She just asked me for one, and I was saying, well, like the Bliss case. No, it's what I...
Would you have the cite for that offhand by chance,
I
Ms.
do.
Carl?
I can get you that.
Thank you.
And so that's, and then, of course, the laws with respect to the tax
And does Bliss
code.
Say that if there's a factual error, that can prevent a distribution?
It says, no. It says okay. that the findings, you know, if there's a factual where it appears they just lifted findings that maybe you didn't get your impartial hearing. So we're saying here that, you know, she's asking me some law or case, and I'm just saying, well, here's a case. This you could look at everything in there, all these facts and how they wrote them, and they just lifted things from the other party's affidavit that are clearly wrong. They have wrong dates in them. They have wrong dollar amounts. I mean, it's obvious. They just picked up that affidavit and plugged it in.
But it seems like your main argument here is that the court abused its discretion by approving this distribution because of this huge potential tax liability.
Not just the tax liability. I mean, the whole situation, needing to take a closer look at this case as to what the
But that's not what you've argued in your brief.
Well, what
you
argued PRs
in your brief
doing.
Is that there's not enough money in the estate to pay for this potential tax obligation.
And we also
showed... You dispute the court's... Let me finish.
Sure.
You dispute the court's rejection of your client's affidavit and the statements in his affidavit that you call facts that the court should have relied on. You could have provided the court with an affidavit from a CPA that said, this estate needs to do these. That might have caused the court to take a different look at it other than unsupported allegations in an affidavit of a party. So well, how is the rejection of that by the district court an abuse of discretion?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't have that information to have a CPA look at it. That's why we asked the court, there's enough here to look at.
I mean, you know, following up on Judge Flores' question, I mean, that's your problem. I mean, if you want to make these arguments, if you want to say, here are these tax liabilities, it's going to wipe out the money in the distribution, stop proceedings, then I think it was the obligation at the district court to present the documentation and affidavits that Judge Flores is talking about. I mean, because then I would say, whoa, wait a minute, you know.
Well, the rule does say that the court, that you can ask that a CPA review the documents if the court isn't inclined to feel that they have, you know, the expertise. That was the purpose of the line about the CPA, because we had said that we asked for a CPA and we asked for an attorney to review the attorney's fees and a CPA to look at the tax question. We specifically asked for that so that we would know, because we didn't have this information. But with respect to those attorney's fees, it was in Cass County, not Crow Wing County. And what happened to the money? The $100,000 on the first mortgage was set up to, I see I'm flashing here.
If you'd like to just, you know.
Wrap that up?
Yes.
Okay, the $100,000 was used to get funds for a settlement. But the other side wanted everything. There was no discounting or anything, so we didn't reach a settlement. And then what my client did is he had put a mortgage on his homestead to purchase the property because he bought the property for $185,000 and it didn't appraise up to that amount. So he had to put it on his homestead. So once he wasn't able to settle, he moved what he had on his homestead to the property, which was the subject for the loan that he took out. That's what he did, because the district court had put the value of the home at $285,000 and it didn't even value up to $185,000. So that's why then there wasn't any equity in them for them to sell it.
In the cabin?
Yeah.
Got
the lake home, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms.